Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilt, your host. Today I'm talking to Clint Greenleaf. He's the CEO and founder of the Greenleaf Book Group. And I think we're going to talk about a lot of different things, but first I want to give Clint a chance to talk a little bit about your background and how you got into the book business and what Greenleaf is about today.
Sure. Thanks, David. Thanks for having me. The background is probably a little less traditional than the average person in publishing. I was a Marine in college and spent some time in ROTC there, and then ripped out my shoulder and was forced to get a real job. I went into accounting, which I'm not sure if that was really a real job or not, but went into to go work at Deloitte & Touche and earned my CPA, but really didn't enjoy it very much. And most of my friends were kind of shocked that I even got the job, because I tend to be a bit of a knucklehead, and I wasn't really that serious about accounting. But they asked how I actually got employed and how that all worked out. And I told them, well, I dressed the part. I did everything the Marines taught me to do. I tied my tie. I shined my shoes. And they said, well, if you're so smart and that really works so well, you should write a book, because then you can be a big famous author. And they meant it completely as a joke. And I took it completely as a joke. But I said, well, tell you what, if you buy me a keg of beer, I will do this. And so what started off as a complete joke quickly turned into a 28-page booklet that I printed at the Kinko's in town. I handed them my so-called book, and they felt like they kind of got shortchanged, so they bought me a keg of Natty Light instead of a real beer. And that was the...
Because the book was so small.
Exactly, yeah, it was 28 pages, saddle-stitched. I mean, it was. I did the illustrations myself. It wasn't exactly a piece of production genius by any means. So we all had a good laugh at that, and that was kind of the end of it. Well, my dad convinced me to put a little ad in Bottom Line Personal, which was a little newsletter going out at the time, and it was a free ad, so I sent it, put it in there. And when I went to go work at Deloitte, I was really not really all that engaged by accounting. Some would say I hated it. So while I was working at Deloitte, I was getting orders for these books. The first day, I think I had 2 orders, the next day 7, the next day 13. And within a month, I was pulling between 50 and 100 $5 checks out of a P.O. box. And that was all going on while I was working as a staff accountant. And so it didn't take me very long, using the accounting skills that I'd learned, to recognize I was making a hell of a lot more money selling books than I was actually doing accounting. So I retired at 22 and started a publishing company, knowing absolutely nothing about publishing. And from there, kind of built Greenleaf Book Group as the company it is now over the last 13 years.
So maybe I think it would be worthwhile for you to talk a little bit about, I mean, you know, obviously people can go to your website and they can read what you have to say there, but maybe you could sum up what it is that distinguishes Greenleaf. You're both a publisher and distributor, so you do two different jobs there, but maybe you could kind of sum it up so that we can then talk a little bit about what that means in terms of your perspective on the book business.
Sure. When I started the business, I realized that I couldn't really compete with the big houses on things like Advance and a lot of those big pieces. So I knew what I could compete on would be distribution and production quality. So I built a model to basically give people the high-end distribution they would get through a major traditional publisher. I would give them the same high-end quality they've got, but I had to give them something else. And what I settled on at the time, because I didn't have any other real choice, was to give them all the rights to their product. So the clients who work with us have the freedom to leave us at any point in time. When they sign on to work with us, they give us the chance to distribute or sell a specific medium. So they might give us paperback or hardcover, but they keep everything else. So it's really an author-centric model where the authors retain all the rights to everything. When we sell their books in the trade, we get a piece of the sale on it. But when they sell books on their own, if they're a speaker or they do a bulk sale on their own, they get 100% of the proceeds.
Right. They pay for the production cost, the pre-press production, editorial, and printing. And
right.
Then, so if they sell their own books, they basically, even if they can hire you to produce the books, or they can produce them themselves.
Yeah, so that's a great point. So we do the service work only because people ask us to do it, but our clients are not required to use us for the service work.
But you obviously must have some quality standards. If let's say I walk in the door and I've already printed my book and I've done it the amateur way, which is, you know, no copy editing, no proofreading, or I've done all those things myself, having read a book about it. And I designed it in Microsoft Publisher, and I took it, as you did, down to Kinko's.
My skin is crawling right now, by the way. I can actually feel it.
Right. And I bring this to you. And the work, you know, then you have to look at it and say, I can't distribute that because it won't meet the standards of the book industry.
Right. So what we try and do, and it's this crazy concept of actually giving real feedback. When I was originally trying to take my book out to market, I remember getting mimeographed rejection letters back. And it wasn't just that purple mimeograph. I mean, it had been mimeographed so many times that it kind of had like the tilt to it where it had been rotated a few times. And you could see the outlines of the previous mimeographed editions on this. And it just says it doesn't fit our needs at the time. If that book you described comes in, we'll review it and try and see if there's anything good in it. Because, frankly, a lot of really, really great books started off like just like the book you mentioned. So we'll look at it and say, wow, this is actually a really compelling story. If you wanted to invest in this, you could make it a lot more. Or, wow, this is a pretty limited scope project. We wish you all the best. And there's a lot of print-on-demand firms who can help you, create a couple more copies of this if you want it, but it's really not a good fit for us. We accept about 3% of the books that come into us.
And that's both for distribution and for publishing?
It's the aggregate. Distribution's a little bit smaller because when we take a book, it becomes kind of a binary decision. Hopefully the production quality is great, but a lot of the photography books we get, for example, are just not going to fit for us because if it's not incredibly high-end production work, if someone's already printed 5,000 units of it, there's not much I can do if it's not good quality.
So do you feel that for you, there's a certain number of titles per year that you are equipped to do well and that you will limit the number of titles you take? Or do you say, well, if I got a run of really good books, I'll just bring in some more resources to match the number of books that I have?
Much more the latter. I mean, I'm a capitalist pig. I'm an entrepreneur. Publishing is definitely where I spend my time. But I am primarily in this to create a beautiful business that makes a lot of money with integrity. So if I can find an extra, we do about 100 to 150 books a year, it's kind of our current run rate. If I found 390 books tomorrow, I would find a way to make 390 books get into the market today.
Right, and I noticed you have multiple imprints of your own. This is aside from the distribution business. How do you determine, what got you to the imprint model? Because, you know, in the book business, typically, imprint serves the purpose of organizing under the publisher side. It may not mean anything to the eventual buyer of the book.
Right.
So what got you to create the imprints?
Well, that's a great question because I think oftentimes if you ask a consumer what's the last book they read by X major publisher, by Random House, Simon, and one of those guys, they will look at you like, my dog looks at me when I ask her the same question, kind of tilt the head and they have no idea what you're talking about. The imprint designation, I think, is one of those things that it usually is something we all stress about and worry about in our own business. I think Thomas Nelson did an interesting thing by getting rid of all their imprints. What we do is basically a classification method. So we have, for example, Olive Tree Books is our religious line, our Christian line of books. It's relatively small right now, but the Christian distribution model is different from the traditional book distribution model. Greenleaf Book Group and Greenleaf Book Group Press are distributed by our primary distribution model. Emerald Book Company had been a more limited distribution model, but now is becoming a lot more like Greenleaf, and the question is, do we separate the two of them out anymore? It's kind of becoming, as they parallel each other so much more, what's the point in separating them out?
It wasn't Irish Books, though.
No, and frankly, we're just really, really, I'm just really arrogant, so, you know, Greenleaf, Emerald, Olive Tree, all these things are based on my name. We're probably not going to have, like, Red Rocket Books ever.
Right, unless you marry someone named Red Rocket. Or something.
Yeah, my wife is a redhead, but she's still not interested in that at all.
So with the current list, is it principally kind of business, aside from the Christian line, but business self-help consulting people who are writing books about how to do something, is that kind of the range that you focus on, or is it broader than that?
No, that's probably two-thirds to probably 80% or so of what we do. And there's two main reasons for it. You know, I spend a good bit of time reading business books myself. But if you look at the backlist sales percentage of something like a kid's book, you're going to see the backlist is the greater majority of the sales for the kids' books. Well, I don't really have any great backlist books. I don't have Curious George. I don't have Dr. Seuss. So I can't really compete as well in that space. But a book from 1960 on HR is probably not going to be all that successful. So you have much better churn in the business market. So for a new publisher starting out, I think you're much better off starting in a space where, you know, new titles and front lists will do better. The other benefit is that on the printed side of books, at least, the average CEO or manager of a business has a lot of business books on a bookshelf. They may not have read them all, but I think almost every CEO that I know has a copy of Good to Great in their office, more as a badge of honor to say, yes, I have purchased this book, which implies I've actually read this book, but, you know, that's more secondary than the fact that I've actually purchased this book. And so the business book side is something people kind of hang on to and keep as a matter of that badge of accomplishment, the fact that they've got it. So business tends to be a pretty good seller for us. We've been pretty successful with it.
And do you work, typically with business books, the greater numbers come from when companies discover a book, or somebody in a company discovers a book and says, you know, like a book on sales, and they've got a sales force of 1,000 people, I'm going to buy one copy for everybody, because every year they do professional development workshops, they do, you know, internal company work, especially in sales, but also in marketing and HR, you know, that typically the book sales in bulk, what are called special sales in the book business, are really powerful. Is that something that you focus on?
We love special sales, and that's something that I think the big-time future of the business is still going to focus on that as well. I technically keep up my CPA requirement for state of Texas and state of Ohio, and in order to do that, I had to take CPE courses. CPE is all going online. That's continuing professional education. That's all going online. The thing of it is that the education you have for a sales company or inside internally, it's very rarely going to be something that you can go to a conference and they'll hand you an ebook. Usually what they're going to do is they'll give you a couple physical books so you feel like you have something tangible to do. So I think the special sales area is definitely a big growing area for us. I think the reference area, you know, you remember going to school and having 80 pounds of books in your book bag. I think in that area we're going to see some big changes. But for the special sales side of the gift side, you know, people who have a book as a business card and want to give it out to people, there's something very beneficial about that tangible product.
Well, so actually this is a good lead-in to a bunch of questions that I have I'd really like, because you work directly with authors.
Mm-hmm.
In many, you know, the people who have, they may be entrepreneurial, they may be, you know, maybe they don't want to wait to find a big publisher, maybe they are just, they want the control. But for whatever reason, you're gonna deal with authors who have a book, so you're kind of on the front line of dealing with the production side. You're also on the front line as a distributor in the sales side, or the consumer side, and I want to talk a little bit about which you just sort of raised, how does digital publishing fit in? When you talk to authors now, you know, obviously, you know, they're all paying attention to what's going on. I hear this all the time, you know, will you get my book onto Kindle? Will you get my book onto the Nook? Is it going to be on the iPhone? Is it going to be on the Android? Are you hearing a lot of that? And not only are you hearing about it, but then how do you guide your clientele in looking both at the present and future for what's going to happen with and the relationship between digital publishing and print?
Sure. Forgive me, I'm going to go on a bit of a soliloquy here, but the first answer is yes, we do all that kind of stuff, and I think every publisher will. It's going to become no different from the old days of do you sell to libraries and do you sell to bookstores. You know, it's another outlet, it's another vehicle for it. Everyone will be doing that near term. We do it already. One of the questions the authors seem to have is they get really stressed out about how this plays. I was just at the 800 CEO Read powwow that they have up in Milwaukee this week, and we were talking about the same issue, and people kept on saying, a lot of authors were there, and they were asking directly, well, what does this mean for me? How does this really play out? And I said, look, with all due respect, you're putting your energy and your focus in the exact wrong space. If you think back to Kenny Rogers, who had his music on LPs way back in the day, when the 8-track came out, he didn't stop singing or freak out. They started selling on LPs and 8-tracks. And then the cassette came out, and he didn't really care that the 8-track went away when the cassette started playing. And the CD, and he kept on doing his work. The vehicle or the mechanism by which the end consumer gets the data or the content, whether it's music or books or whatever it is really inconsequential to the content provider. It doesn't really matter. I think we've left this or world. Do you want a CD or a cassette? Do you want a MP3 download or do you want the album? It's all about the and world. So if you think about this from the author's perspective, they just need to make sure that everybody can get it any way they want it. I like to listen to a lot of audiobooks. I also like to read. I also have an iPad and like to read on the e-side as well. It doesn't really matter to me which way I sell product to somebody. As long as they get it in the method that they want the most, it's easiest for them to do it. So I think the publisher's role in all this is to make it really, really easy to take one source of content from the content provider and give it to the end consumer in the easiest way possible. And that's where, you know, we've been kind of dumb lucky in this role. The last 13 years, we've been both the contact of the author and the contact of the end consumer by selling product as well. I think as we see this industry change and morph, we're going to have a lot more people who are realizing there's just one real step in the process. You know, before you'd have the author who goes to an agent, who goes to a publisher, who goes to a distributor, who goes to a wholesaler, who goes to a retailer, who goes to the end consumer. And now there's going to be one or two people in the middle. And I think the more time that we spend arguing over whether it's going to be this format or not, we lose in the process. I heard a publishing executive tell me, we need to convince the consumer to pay more than $9.95 for an ebook. And I said, with all due respect, I think you're nuts. I mean, you're not going to convince the consumer to do anything at all. The consumer will tell you what they're willing to pay for it, and it's up to us as publishers and as business people to find a way to make that work. If it doesn't work, there won't be any books at that rate, but oddly enough, it will work. You know, you can find a way to make money at that. We just need to change our models a little bit in order to live with the new realities.
So, and I guess that leads to another question. So what are you doing, you know, in terms of, like, does this... think that there are workflow issues, you know, that does go back to the author in the sense that, you know, if you're a self-publishing author or if you're an author who's entrepreneurial and wants to be involved in the process, they're probably going to look to you to say, okay, deliver me your manuscript in a certain way. In other words, you know, you hear people talking about XML workflow, for example, or the advent of HTML5, and these are things that many authors feel uncomfortable with, and they're probably going to look to somebody like you to guide them in figuring out how much of that they need to know or do.
Right. And that's something that I think falls in kind of the more detailed side of it, in that it's going to change so much. The best thing an author can do is focus on the content. But you're right. I mean, there's going to be a need for this sort of thing. I spoke with Jim Collins a year or two ago and asked him what he was really looking for in a publisher. And he kind of smiled. He said, well, you know, I'm not sure that I really need a publisher, but I do want a publisher to take care of all the details for me. I don't really care about formatting ebooks. I don't really care about shipping and logistics. I do care about writing, and I want to focus on that and make that work. So as we spent more time trying to build that model, I think for us it's a matter of making it as easy as possible for the author, not have to worry about it. I will say that I think as technology changes, it's going to get to a point that you can take a Word document, you can hit an EPUB button in Word, and it'll create a Kindle-ready or an iPad-ready ebook.
Yeah, I suspect you're right. I think that we are still at very early stages, and the tools have not. You know, it's sort of like with the same thing with apps. I see, you know, that has evolved rapidly. You know, a couple of years ago, and even with building your own website. You know, at one time you'd have to hire somebody, experts who had really secret knowledge. It was really valuable. Pay somebody $25,000 to $50,000 to build you a website. Today, the tools have evolved so that, you know, obviously you still need professional help in certain places, but it's a lot easier to create a website, and it doesn't cost $25,000 now.
Yeah, I mean, you can go on GoDaddy and point and click and set up a website in an hour.
Right, although you could, it's sort of like a little bit like, you know, self-publishing online models where you can point and click and make a book, but you're limited in by the templates, and you know, you don't necessarily, your content may not fit the way the template operates. So I mean, there's still, I think, a value add from a business like yours, and I think that's true also of the app building and the website building, that there is still useful to bring professional advice and service into the workflow that will make it a better device.
Yeah, and that's a great point. Let me try and hit on that. When you think about this, think of how many websites there are now versus what there were, you know, when the internet got started in the late 90s. And you think back to this, you could probably navigate most publishing websites in a day or two back in the old days. Because, you know, there wasn't, Dan Pointer had a website pretty early on. The big houses had websites pretty early on. Maybe John Kramer did too. There weren't a whole lot of websites early on. Now there are so many, there's no way to be able to tell. So you really have to go and vet that content somehow. So I think there's always going to be need for people like editors and, you know, attractive designers who are able to give you great content and make things look pretty. But as there's more and more and more stuff, there's going to be a need to find an aggregator to tell you what is the best of all this sort of stuff. You mentioned apps. I mean, think of how many iPad apps or iPhone apps there are out there that you're never going to see, because they always show you the top 100. Well, there's probably some pretty good ones at number 375.
Or even at 3,050. You know,
right.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about that. But I do want to go back a little bit to the conversation earlier about, you know, what, when you started talking about Jim Collins, because I think this is an important point. I've heard people say they worry that authors of a certain stature will decide at a certain point that they don't need publishers. And I think what I hear you saying is they may not need a traditional publisher, but they still need an entity that provides the services and the facilities that a publisher provides, because authors, as you said, don't want to be involved in the details that Greenleaf Book Group or many other companies will do.
Right. I mean, I've got little kids at home. We could probably make our own baby food. We have the skill set for it. We have the tools. We could probably go to the Whole Foods and get the ingredients for it. But it's a lot easier for me just to actually go to the store and get pre-made baby food, because it works really well. At a certain point, people who say, well, I can do this myself, I can go on Amazon and create a Kindle book on my own through Creative Space or all these different features, those are all options for you. But at a certain point, is it really worth your time and energy to give up not just the time and money that goes into it, but also some of the benefits that someone else can bring to the table? And I think as we spend more and more time in this new space, we're going to find that there are going to be a lot of people like a Seth Godin who say, you know, I don't need a traditional publisher, but I'm still going to team up with Amazon to do this. You know, if you look at the way that Jim Collins did How the Mighty Fall, that was a very, very special non-traditional arrangement he did with Collins Business. People do very traditional things right now, and I think they're going to start meandering into a very different space where they're going to be doing more self-publishing with a little bit of independent publishing with a little bit of traditional publishing all mixed in.
So do you think, looking on the other side of the equation, on the sell side, just thinking about retail books, retail book business, bookstores, you know, what is going on there? Do you think about the future of retailing? Because obviously you have to be able to navigate what is going to happen for your client authors.
You know, that's a great question. Every time I think I have some kind of clue on what's going on, I get flabbergasted by a news story. So this week we heard that Borders was thinking about buying Barnes & Noble.
It's a great story.
Yeah, I mean, as I picked my jaw up off the ground and tried to run the numbers and how they could possibly even pull that off, I started thinking about this. And if anyone who's been into a Barnes & Noble in the last few months has noticed that you can't really make it through the door without being accosted by trying to have someone sell you a Nook. And you realize that the actual traditional bookstore model is changing very, very rapidly. So I don't really know where it's headed exactly, but what I can tell you is I think there's still going to be a need for people to have physical bookstores. You know, you look at a Best Buy, and Best Buy, in theory, could be entirely online. No one would go out and buy technology, but people still want to go look, touch, feel, and that sort of thing. So if nothing else, a bookstore is a showroom for product, and there's still going to be a need for some sort of showroom for that product.
Now, what's the economics, though? I mean, I was thinking about this even this morning, when you know, thinking about independent bookstores and Google editions, because independent stores are trying to now be able to sell ebooks in their physical space and as well as on their websites. And I think the same issue exists for the Barnes & Noble and the Borders, the large chains. As you say, they can be a showroom to show you. I mean, you need the physical touch, but how do they make money?
Right. Well, that's a much harder equation. I think if I figured that out, I'd probably make an offer for Barnes & Noble myself. I think what happens is that Barnes & Noble and Borders are going to need to find a way to monetize more than just the actual book itself. There are people who, and I'm sure anyone in publishing has heard this, that, you know, someone will ask you, a stranger will ask you, what do you think about the changing e-books? And I don't think I could ever give up my printed book. Well, I think a lot of people say things like that until they actually start reading books on Kindles and iPads and recognize it's not that hard of a transition to make, and, oh, my God, I can actually search for the content I want. It's pretty easy to do. So we're going to find that Barnes & Noble may be onto something by having the actual Nook in the store and, you know, making it a bit of a technology store that happens to also have a few samples in the store as well. But, again, it's going to be the and model. So some people still want the physical book. Some people want the e-book. You know, Nelson tried Nelson Free, where they gave out, if you bought the physical book, they would give you the e-book and the audio book as well.
Right.
And it hasn't really worked all that well for them. But the concept, I think, is really solid in that you want to give people whatever they want, however they want to get it.
Well, so does that apply when you're talking, I know we're jumping around a little bit, but does that apply when, let's say you're talking to an author comes to you and says, I've got this great idea for a book, and you agree, and let's say it's a business book, and it's got really strong sales. Let's say it's sales and marketing. It tells you how to be a great salesperson. And so you help them publish the book. Do you have a strategy that you feel will work for them today, or do you feel it has to be customized for each book in terms of whether they do a print book in paperback or hardcover? If they do an ebook, do they do it on the various platforms, or do they do it as a PDF to either sell or give away on their own website? You know, if you advise them on, let's say you're going in to talk to a business group, and you've got 250 people in the room, and of course you're going to sell them or give them the physical book because that's the artifact that people really need to hold on to. But how does the digital publishing version fit in? I mean, do you have something in mind there, or are you seeing that as individuated to each client that you talk to?
I think my population size is too small to say there's no pattern yet, but so far we've done too small of a number of these to be able to tell you that, oh, everybody should do X or Y or Z, or the greater majority of people should do X or Y or Z. So far it's been a very individualized decision. Some of the old standards, like you never do a hardcover parenting book, or most business books should come out on the hardcover side first. Some of those ideas still kind of play in the traditional space, but you still want to make sure that you're pricing it correctly. I mean, right now, with the economy as tight as it is, the buyers of the major chains do not want to pick up expensive books. So if you can make a book less expensive by making it paperback, it usually will sell better right now. That will always change, and it's always kind of a moving target, and each genre is specific and different as well. So if you look then at the ebook side too, if the author has goals and intentions of becoming a New York Times bestseller, well, they might not be as interested in giving away the ebook as a PDF on their website to everybody in the free world. Tim Ferriss would probably disagree with me and tell me that's exactly how you get to be a New York Times bestseller. But depending on the strategy you want to go out after, you really want to customize the approach for each person. Generally speaking, I like the idea of giving something away free and getting people excited about it. But the artifact sale has to actually happen. You know, people can be excited about it and just like it for what it is and not monetize it yet. So it has to be some kind of end game to monetize the content. And some authors, the monetization is just being able to speak more or being a consultant and getting more consulting gigs, in which case everything is considered to be a free giveaway and they just want to be able to monetize the back end.
Right, it's a tool. Now, and actually is a good question, because I was just thinking that if somebody came to you and said, I want to produce these books, everything's going to be free because I really only am going to make money as a consultant, or, you know, a company's going to hire me, I'm going to go on a cruise and talk to all of their employees. There, of course, nothing is being sold, so you wouldn't be able to make any money. Obviously, you would have to come up with an alternative for you to get compensated.
Right. So we've talked to a few people who've liked that idea when they came and talked to us, and we said, well, is there any value in having your book up on Amazon? And they usually say yes and say, well, giving it away probably doesn't help anybody. So what if we sell it on Amazon? And if the person has a big enough platform, the traditional publishing is very scarce. It's really run by scarcity, where if you tell a publisher, I plan on giving away a book, everyone thinks, oh, God, if you give away 100 books, it's 100 sales I lost. We tend to think of it a little bit differently. If you give away 100 books, that very well might translate out into another 200 copies sold over the course of the next year if the book is good. People like it and read it and go out and buy more copies of it. So if it's done correctly, you can actually have a giving program that results in a lot of sales. And, there's good examples of that. In one sense, a library sale is kind of the same idea, right? If you sell one copy to a library, you can expect 6 sales over the next 2 years from people who go out and get the book and go out and buy more copies later on. So if there's a good plan for it, yes. If it's someone who wants to have a corporate giveaway and they just want to do a Christmas party gift and give it to everybody at the end of the year, that's really a hard one for us to make money on. So we'd have to figure out a different way to work for that.
Right. Now, and of course, that gets into this other question. I assume that you must provide marketing services. You would help people with their social media, people who come to you and ask you to be their publisher. I would guess you will then find yourself in the position of having to provide them with additional services.
Yes, and that's actually how everything that we do kind of got started. I didn't really start off wanting to have editors working in-house or designers working in-house or a marketing team or all that sort of stuff. I started off just trying to sell product, and everything else came because the authors needed it, but from someone or another, they needed to get the help to be able to do it. So our new big push is on platform building. Every publisher tells you they want somebody with a platform, but no one really does a good job of helping you get that platform. So that's really kind of the secret sauce for us, I think, where we can really add value to our authors. And oh, by the way, we'll also sell more product, which makes more money for me. So being a capitalist pig has its advantages at times.
Well, I think the obvious, you're in partnership with the author, so anything the author does to promote and sell is beneficial to you, but similarly, anything you can do to promote and sell is beneficial to the author.
Yep, it's this crazy idea of we're all on the same side and we all want to make money together.
Well, I think it's a good place to be. Now, if looking toward the future, and I kind of like this idea of asking you to imagine how things are going to go over the next 10 years, because, it's really hard to do, and it gives you a chance to kind of visualize free of reality in a way. But if, is there anything that you see the future of publishing that you want to talk about?
Well, I would say that for the last 580 years or so since movable type was put out, publishing hasn't had to go through a hell of a lot of changes. Computers giving easier pre-press work, it definitely changed things a little bit. But generally speaking, we haven't really changed that much. I think a publisher has always thought of it as ink on paper and making the author's words a little bit easier for other people to hear. I think it's going to change a lot more drastically in the near term. I think a lot of publishers are going to either just totally change their model or go away and not really continue to exist. And I think those who will be really successful will be the ones who continue to serve their two masters. And I think in most cases, every business has two masters. You just have to figure the two of them out. In publishing, I think one master is obviously the end consumer who pays for the product at the end. The other one is the content provider, because if the publisher does not do a good job of taking care of the content provider, it's getting easier and easier for the content provider to say nuts to you, a la Seth Godin, and walk away. So I think we're going to see publishers changing drastically and leaving the we do books kind of mindset and doing a whole lot more, whether that's becoming more involved in the speaking side and the consulting side. That may be doing more events. I'm not sure exactly how it changes, but I see there being a much bigger role for the publisher or no role at all. And those who will be successful, I think, will take the standard of jumping up and trying to do more for their authors and more for the end consumer to get them the books they want the way they want them.
Well, I think that's actually a pretty good observation, obviously, and I assume you want to be in that group.
We are fighting like hell to get in that group, as, or if not, at least create that group. You know, no one else seems to be in it. I just want to be the. I want to make sure that I'm in it.
Well, do you think, actually, then it raises another good question. Do you feel like you have to be constantly an innovator, you know, at the leading edge of publishing in order to be in that position?
You know, that's a great question. I'll, again, quote Jim Collins on this real quickly. He said that it's not never the company that innovates the most that is successful in the end. It's the one who innovates enough. And, you know, you just think back to Betamax versus VHS, right? Beta was by far better than VHS. But VHS made it because they innovated enough. And, you know, the VCR was a simple concept, but they didn't spend all their time innovating and tweaking too much. What I want to do is create the right big decisions and spend most of my time on the big pieces. So for us right now, platform development is still kind of the big piece that we want to spend our time on. I want to make sure that our authors have the best shot at good platform development. I may not have the most innovative platform development business that I can offer my authors, but as long as it's good enough that I can get them great service and value and make sure that it's successful for them, I do want to be in the forefront. I guess I don't feel like I need to be the most innovative, but I do want to be in the forefront.
I think that's a good place to be. Well, thanks so much, Clint, for talking to me today. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I've been talking to Clint Greenleaf, whose company is Greenleaf Book Group, which is obviously greenleafbookgroup.com. It's really been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thanks for having me, David. Appreciate it.